The fifth case for argument this morning is United States against Lauderdale.
Morning. May it please the court.
Ms. Kister.
Thank you, Your Honor. Didn't mean to jump the gun there. I'll be brief. I know we're running late. What was at issue here were a number of telephone records that, by all accounts, were received late in the trial process. These were phone records, some dozen records, on which Agent Lammers, the caseworker, the summary witness for the government, on which he was examined. And these records made a difference. As the court is aware, this was the second trial in this matter. It had been tried once before. The government did not originally have these records. What it had is, in essence, was a number of informants or co-defendants testifying that Mr. Lauderdale was part of this conspiracy. And that was essentially the crux of the government's case the first time around. Mr. Lauderdale was not found with any physical evidence. He wasn't found with any narcotics. He was peripheral, physically arriving on the scene late, arrested late. They didn't have a lot of evidence on him. They had informants' testimony. The second time round, they got these records. It made a difference. These were corroborating records, telephone records that put these three individuals together, put their phones together, put them in conversation and in communication with each other right around the events and the transactions involving these narcotics. And they were records that, by all accounts, the government came to late, as I say. I don't think there's any dispute in that. Mr. Llewellyn, trial counsel, endeavored to exclude the use of these records. He received them possibly in a couple of batches, but in any event, very late in the process. He didn't have any opportunity to evaluate these. I would submit that had he had the opportunity to review them, understood their contents, it might have made a difference in how he defended the case.
He's now had a year to evaluate them. You haven't articulated any way in which the case could have been tried differently.
Well, he didn't have a year at the time he received these documents. He had
a year now, so one could say in an appellate brief, here's what we would have done differently. But your brief doesn't identify anything that defense would
possibly
have done differently.
Excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Your Honor. Possibly the need to put the defendant on. And I think these are decisions you have to know and evaluate at the outset of a case and not in the 11th hour. Those records had to be addressed. They were damaging. They were material. They created an entirely different beast to this case, and they needed to be addressed. And I think they would have affected how the case was defended and tried had Mr. Llewellyn had the opportunity to have them produced timely and reviewed them in advance of the trial itself.
Had he taken the stand, decided to testify, there have been a lot more telephone records that would have been admitted than were.
Yes, Your Honor, and I'm not suggesting that that would have been by any means the perfect avenue to take, but the defendant in this case, in any event, was entitled to know the contents of what the government had and didn't know them, hadn't seen them. And these were some couple hundred.
Wait. I thought it was agreed that the records had been disclosed 2 weeks before trial. The district judge kept out those things that had not been disclosed before trial and allowed in those things that had been. Are you now saying that the district judge allowed in things that were not properly disclosed under Rule 16?
I think there's some dispute as to when each of these documents was produced. I think that Mr. Llewellyn, he made a record that he didn't have the opportunity to look at any of them. The ones that were first produced were at the end of January. They would have arrived in Arkansas, where he officed, at the beginning of February. At some point in time, he was in transit to try the case in Illinois. In any event, he didn't receive, I believe, any of these documents. And even if he had, Your Honor, I'm not sure that that a couple of days is enough time to make a decision as to how they're going to impact the defense of the case. If there's anything else, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Crow.
Good morning, Your Honor. So may it please the Court. James.
Do not touch the microphone.
Beg your pardon, Your Honor. I've been asked to move it up in the past. I beg your pardon.
You can raise or lower that if you want. There's a button underneath.
Okay. I think I'll leave my damage done, Your Honor. Thank you. Your Honors, taking in turn the points raised by counsel for the appellant, I'd submit that respectfully that under the doctrine of the Eskridge decision that this Court entered, these records were not critical, but rather cumulative. And to the extent that the evidence that they contained would have differed from the evidence that trial counsel had been able to preview in the first trial, it's only in as much as they corroborate some of the evidence that was received in both trials, that evidence being the direct testimony of two co-conspirators who testified that they had been in telephonic contact through using, among others, the physical telephone seized from all three defendants at the time of their arrest, all those communications relating to narcotics trafficking. Moreover, the additional evidence at the first trial, which is available in the government exhibit list at document 81, although those documents are not of record, the textual descriptions of the exhibits are the same in both cases, include what is referenced in government's exhibit H in this case and is part of our separate appendix, which are the only real key records here, which are a few pages of the defendant, Ronnie Lauderdale's phone records, evincing his direct communication with co-defendant Jesse Lee Hale in the hours, days, and minutes leading up to his arrest. I take exception to counsel's assertion that he was a latecomer to this. He was the last person arrested. However, he was arrested with a firearm under the front seat of his car in which he had traveled overnight after being notified by a co-defendant that their load of 20 kilos of cocaine had been moved and there was an issue. He shows up within minutes of agents locating the remaining 18 and a half kilos of that cocaine. And notably, if he did not testify, he already had testified indirectly, and that testimony was related by Task Force Officer Lammers. The post-arrest statement given by Defendant Lauderdale was telling, from the gun that he readily admitted to being his to the cocaine that he readily admitted having received from Mexican drug traffickers, all the way down to the mile post and a truck stop at which he received it in Arkansas, did he tell those agents. So had he testified, first of all, the damage would have been even greater because he had this detailed post-arrest statement. There were no vagaries around which he could dance. Secondly, the court had denied at a late juncture in the trial the government's offer of 404B evidence, which would have included seven prior drug trafficking felonies of which this defendant had been convicted. The district court's comment at that point, in fact, was, I understand this may be proper, however, you just don't need it. That was the basis for excluding the 404B evidence. That came on the heels of the district court's finding that the two incarcerated individuals, Marcel Fields and this other individual incarcerated with Mr. Lauderdale, who had received information that he wished to kill his co-defendant, John Ball, alternatively the co-defendant's girlfriend, Shanika Wagner, who had witnessed Lauderdale handle the bag of 18 and a half kilos of cocaine, and alternatively still hassle or send a message to John Ball's mother, were all what the district court received or assessed to be the most damning evidence in the case. Appellate counsel asserts that these records made a difference. Based on the references I put in my brief demonstrating the cumulative nature of these records and the fact that at the time the evidence that had already been adduced on the point of telephonic communications was unchallenged in both trials, and as I point out in the brief, in fact, defense counsel buys into the fact that these individuals, these three co-conspirators, are in communication. But in fact, its theory of defense in both cases was rather that Lauderdale's statement was one that had been somehow fabricated by the DEA agent, taking a page out of the fact that John Ball's statement had been videotaped and Lauderdale's statement had been not, and trying to essentially discredit that case agent's testimony rather than the fact of these extensive communications. I wish to make clear the timing because that has been reopened here this morning. The government made an offer of proof that is in our appendix, and it makes it eminently clear exactly what was produced when, especially when coupled with the transcript. Exhibits C through G are the letters that I sent to defense counsel for every production of documents, all of which were Bates labeled, Each of these exhibits was likewise base labeled, so they could correlate that on the record with the district court. The district court excluded those records that were produced the Thursday and Friday before trial, even finding that at that time that they had been produced within 24 hours of the government's receipt of the same. All records produced 2 weeks or more before trial were permitted to be admitted. In terms of the records not being available between trials, the appellant asserts that these records were crucial to our successful prosecution of the case based on the mistrial granted in the first case. In fact, Your Honors, I'd submit it's much the reverse. The defendant was left in the first trial to argue merely about the absence of phone records rather than challenging the corroborative evidence received in the case. The same extensive quantum of physical and testimonial evidence was received in both cases. At the end of the day, Your Honors, the government's case would not have been significantly less persuasive had these exhibits not been referenced on the record. In fact, it would have been equally persuasive based on the corroborative cumulative evidence already received by the court. And in fact, the test I'd note as applied in the cases cited by the defendant are in more egregious circumstances involving 404B evidence, Bruton issues, and Jenks Act violations. This is, if it is a Rule 16 issue, one that the defendant even concedes there was no Rule 16 violation, inasmuch as the defendant discovered or produced all of the requisite documents. They challenge only the district court's remedy that is fashioned. And if it is treated by this court as a Rule 16 issue, under Rule 16D, the district court's discretion in fashioning a remedy for any violation of the rule, of which here there is none, as agreed by the parties, is broad. And therefore, based on the broad discretion afforded the district court here, it did not err in fashioning the remedy that it did. Moreover, and as we've represented in our brief, we agree upon the standard of harmless error cited by the defendant. Here, if there were any error on the part of the district court, we respectfully submit it was harmless, and harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, given the great quantum of evidence received by the district court and the jurors in the case.
Now, I'm not sure. Of course, doesn't really make any difference here, but I'm just curious about the first mistrial. The record tell us, was that an 11-1 mistrial or a 10-2 or?
I'm not sure if it's in the record. I know it was an 11-1, Your Honor, because I was privileged to meet with 10 of the 12 jurors. The district court fashioned made them available, and 10 of the 12 elected to remain with us. That jury, I can tell you, and the record does reflect this, received the case on a Tuesday afternoon of the week leading into the Christmas holiday, where Christmas Eve fell on a Saturday.
Oh, yes.
They worked all the way until Friday intently, and there were 10 very distraught jurors in that case. And all I can reference in the record is that following that case and that one juror who held out, it was the foreperson, and that was of record in the case because all communications after the first note came from someone other than the foreperson against the court's directive.
Again, I'm not saying that's an issue for us, but it's just kind of curious.
Yes. Well, I'd submit, Your Honor, it had nothing to do with the evidence and had to do with the predispositions of that single juror. And there was a recusal of that district judge for a reason I'd submit is related to that, Your Honor. If there are no further questions from the panel, I yield the balance of my time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Crow. Anything further, Ms. Kister?
Obviously, I don't have the benefit of having been present at the trial in this matter. I would defer to government's counsel on that. And the circumstances surrounding that first verdict. I would say, though, that the government in the first case did have the gun. They did have Mr. Lauderdale's post-arrest statement. They did have statements.
But they didn't have was 12 jurors.
Pardon me?
What they didn't have was 12
That's
jurors.
That's true. What they didn't have is a conviction. And they did feel compelled after that first trial to get these new records or these records. I would submit that the records were not cumulative at all. I think they were significant to achieving a conviction in this case. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. And Ms. Kister, we appreciate your willingness to take the appointment in this case and your assistance to both your client and the court. The case is taken under advisement.